Live from across Europe, this is Previously in Europe, a podcast about what's previously in Europe. I'm one of your hosts, Hugh, in London, and I'm here with my beautiful co-host, Kieran, in Berlin. Say hello, Kieran.
It's almost 40 degrees in this very northern European country.
Yes, that's right. We're not going to talk to you about the bullshit that is the replacing the Prime Minister in the UK, or wasn't there like a murder of a politician in Germany recently? That's been looked into.
I mean, we should probably talk about that at some point.
But not today. We're going to talk about Europe. It's on fire.
It is. To give a kind of rundown of what's happening across the continent, as briefly as I can. Increased forest fires in Spain and Portugal. Temperatures are reaching 40 degrees in Germany and Poland. Poland, a classically considered hot country. The state of emergency has been declared in France, where top temperatures are reaching 45 degrees.
Yeah.
There were some proactive measures. Lots of like public baths and things were just like opened or like created and then opened. Yeah, so Europe's on fire and it's going through a heat wave. And one of the fun things that I think people forget about heat waves is that they actually do have a death count.
Yes.
Yeah, I was looking into this recently, and the death count of a heat wave that affected Russia in, I believe it was 2010, was 55,000.
Jesus, that's extensive.
That is extensive. Also, in 2003 in Europe, Europe had like its hottest summer in 500 years. Mm. That had death count of 75,000.
Right. Some more anecdotal evidence. There was a great post on Or Europe, which was just a guy in Italy whose pen had melted next to his notebook.
I saw that, yeah.
The very online North America's response to this normally is like, where's your air conditioning? And I think part of the point that we want to get into in this episode is that if every country in the world behaved like North American countries, climate change would be a much worse problem much faster.
Yeah, right.
And like, sure, we can get air conditioning and better fans, but like that's a very temporary solution that massively increases energy usage and is not really a good foil, and will not fix the problem. But what can we do to fix the problem? Who knows?
Well, some people have some ideas.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to talk about. Yeah, so this episode is about the potential quote-unquote Green New Deal for Europe.
As a part of our recurring section, That Would Be Nice, where we talk about things that would be nice.
Yes, recurring sections are important. So we're going to split this up a bit into Green New Deal stuff I read and Green New Deal stuff you read that are in the same vein but kind of differ on specific things that this calls for and how this actually relates to a pan-European project. As opposed to, I think that this is the part of the problem with the Green New Deal as framing is that it's based on the New Deal from America, which was, an American thing run by the federal government, which has much more sweeping power than the EU has or than any pan-European organization has to kind of force any infrastructure projects on people. But there are some things that can be done within the mechanisms that exist in the EU, and then some additional things national governments could be aiming for that would, be sensible plans and not at all unrealistic.
Yeah. Oof. Let's get started with this because I'm melting.
Yeah. As a caveat, Kieran has graciously turned off his fan that he needs to not melt to improve the sound quality.
Yes, but I have adopted old Spanish woman energy, and I now have a tiny hand fan, which I've learned to open very quickly for emergencies such as this, for our listening pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sold.
It's so good.
So one of the things that we wanted to structure this episode around was the Green New Deal for Europe. Quote-unquote official one that is put forward by the New Economics Foundation, which I believe coined the term a Green New Deal for Europe or Green New Deal potentially in general like 10 years ago. This is just to put in context like how long this has been around as a concept, but very little has happened on it, despite people, you know, outwardly saying that they were going to do things about it. But it has, their like flashy website has 10 pillars, which are not super specific, but they're basically, it's basically around like why this is good framing for it, and here's how, here are 10 things that anyone's plan needs to be measured against in order to see whether or not they're actually going to get things done, or if they're just kind of claiming to be doing good climate policy but not actually doing it. So I'll very briefly run through these and not spend too much time on them, but there will be some editorial critiques.
Fair enough.
Pillar one, meeting the scale of the challenge. This is basically around that the scientists have been pretty upfront with, they need to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees, or there's going to be like some very, very serious ecosystem changes. And 2 degrees is not really an acceptable alternative. So whether or not someone is framing that their plan in, whether or not it tries to meet that goal for the emissions of that country, decides whether or not they're actually doing it well. Pillar two, pressing idle resources into public service. So this is kind of around that the burden of transition shouldn't fall on... this can't be done through like increased taxation or policies that kind of force people to act green themselves. It has to be more around public institutions pushing this.
A societal change rather than an individual change.
Indeed. And like, that's, again, not to say that individual change is not important and you shouldn't basically be like, I can consume what I want because we're going to do institutional change.
It should be, I would largely argue this has been the problem with basically green policy or green initiatives up until very recently, was that it was hyper-focused on the individual and also just not, like, these big changes are required to, like, make it easier for people to actually make the change. This is a common argument I get into with people who talk about, like, going vegan, which is, to a certain extent, I agree with. I, like, kind of agree that maybe society should be vegan. I think that's an underlying thought in a lot of people's heads. Otherwise, there wouldn't be, like, such a fascination with lab-grown meat.
It's also delicious.
But then, like, at the same time, it's, if anyone has ever looked into actually going vegan, you'll realize how ridiculously expensive and time consuming it is. And you have to remember that you, as a podcast listener and a podcast host like me, there are probably people who are in much worse situations financially in terms of like how much precious hours they have to themselves, and plus, you know, feeding a family and things like that. There needs to be societal changes to make things like this, amongst other things, actually feasible.
Yeah, indeed. I think, like, on that point, there's like the once you get down to individual change, you then have the problem of individual nuance need to be taken into account. So, like, the I think a really good classic example of how this relates to the environment is the outrage by a lot of disabled people's advocacy groups around getting rid of plastic straws in the UK. So you can't really get a plastic straw anywhere in like a bar or anything, but there are a lot of people with, like, you know, motor difficulties who were actually quite reliant on straws, and if their straw dissolves, that's a big problem. And it's fine to say, oh, you can just get like a reusable metal straw and bring it with you, and it's like, well, that's fine, but often they're also the people who have money problems. So your solution can't be you buy something now, and you have to kind of come up with a way that both does the environmental thing and also takes into account that people aren't going to be able to adhere necessarily to your strict strict rules. So again, going like going vegan, like, I have a lot of like allergies and dietary problems that would make it very difficult for me to go vegan, because I have tried to do it and look into it and it was working out to be relatively bad for my health to do so because my food options were so limited. But, you know, that doesn't mean that I shouldn't be conscious about it. It just means that we can't say, okay, everyone just has to give up beef and that's the solution to our problem. There's like multi-pronged approaches and has to be structural. Pillar three, empowering citizens and their communities. This is basically saying that it shouldn't be top-down. You can't basically say at an EU or, in the US's case, federal level, you can't just say, like, we're going to do all of this and none of the local... there's no local power or a citizens assembly or a similar type thing put into this decision. You can't just say, like, we put one person in charge, he's the czar and runs everything.
Ah, yes, Zars. We should bring them back. Yeah. Yeah, I agree, and I'm probably going to bring this up later because a lot of the stuff I looked into in regards to like Green New Deal was coming from like Spanish people, yep. And Spain is super into their municipalism.
Mm-hmm. And that often breeds better environmental policies because, you know, on a national level you have the problem of, well, a lot of heavy polluting industries have a lot of strong lobbying power at a national level, but in municipalities they usually don't operate everywhere in that country. Yeah. And in municipalities where they're not a big player, they tend not to have a lot of impact. So if you dole out climate policy partially lower down, then you actually get a lot of improvement by flattening the power structure a bit. Pillar 4, guaranteeing decent jobs. This struck me as quite vague, but I think this goes back to, as we'll get into, the specifics that this organization is trying to put forward. They're basically saying you need to use a Green New Deal. Part of it should be job production and growth in like green industries should be part of it. It can't just be about you need to think about shifting your economy. You can't just think about how can we keep our existing economy as it is but force them to be greener.
Yeah, there's also a little bit of as far as I know, the American Green New Deal is also really big into the jobs guarantee.
Indeed.
Scheme.
Yeah. Which I think pivots back to the why the New Deal is a good good comparison with all of its historical problems. It's why it's worth framing it with this language.
Yeah.
Pillar 5, raising the standard of living. I think this is kind of a basically like no Green New Deal or large scale green policy is going to work if you have to say, okay, all of you have to take like a standard of living cut personally, because people are not going to vote for that.
Yeah.
And they're basically arguing that you can do this as increased investment in things as opposed to taking away things.
Yeah.
And frame it in no one's standard of living is going to like take a massive cut in order to do this, because it is actually feasible to do both. Except unless if someone's standard of living involves like, you know, bathing in oil or something, I don't know. What do people like doing?
What are poor people into?
That's what I'm pretty sure it is. It's all fried food and oil. Pillar 6, entrenching equality. I almost read that as entrenching inequality and managed to reframe it in my head before I said beforehand. Yeah, so this is basically like the combating financialization. Kind of, again, this is going to get into a bit more like a lot of the thinking about climate, carbon emissions can be approached from a very like accounting level way that actually doesn't improve, like entrenches inequality. Because again, if you're doing it from a top down position, you tend to focus on, cool, how can we like convince existing like large multinational companies to do something, but do something in a way that doesn't affect them. Whereas you should be thinking about how can we make everyone do something that doesn't affect individual people. Pillar 7, investing in the future. That's the same as one of the other pillars, in my opinion. But let's move on. Pillar 8, ending the dogma of endless growth. This is kind of like a common thing because so like the New Economic Foundation and DiEM25 are kind of two of the organizations that really push this whole the premise of your economy has to grow every year on using GDP as a measure is kind of silly, because the people who were around formulating GDP as a concept at the time specifically did not intend it for this purpose, and using it as like the, oh, your government is bad because your policies haven't increased the GDP versus last year, it's like, well, that's not actually a good measure of anything. It's a good measure of the economy in general. I think a good example I really liked about this was, if you have an increase in organized crime, your GDP might go up because there's mechanisms in calculating of GDP that add in like the grey economy and things that aren't
the shadow economy.
Economy, that's what I mean. So it's basically like your GDP go because you've increased crime. It's like,
The other example is that like increasing GDP doesn't actually measure progress. A good example that I've always heard is if you went around your neighborhood and you like one night and broke all the windows of all the businesses, the businesses would then have to hire like a window repair guy and, you know, window installers and stuff like that to fix the windows. and GDP will go up in the neighborhood, but nothing would have actually progressed.
Indeed, yeah. I think this is the... I think it's always fun. GDP is very funny in the scope of the people who also rail against the problems of communism. basically being like, oh, communism is a really good way of you top-down organizing... like, thinking about, like, USSR-style communism. You organizing how to make, like, widgets really efficiently in this factory, but that's all you've organized to do well, and that people are just going to, like, overproduce this one thing that you've put a target on. It's like, well, that's exactly what you've done with GDP. You've basically said, okay, cool, to measure this, our capitalism, we're just going to pick this one measure, and you can all just, like, adhere to it. Yeah. But the measure has lots of problems and isn't intended for this, so you've done the exact thing you're complaining about by setting one number that everyone has to stick to.
But it's better because the government didn't decide it. It was decided by a bunch of economists who all went to Davos regularly and now are probably dead.
Indeed, but that's the exact complaint of communism. Like, they're not saying the Central Party was wrong, that they needed more of, like, a particular piece of machinery, but the way people implemented it further down was bad. But, like, that's the exact problem you're describing with GDP. Anyway,
I still love the trend of you capitalism so hard you become the Soviet Union. It's a great trend.
Horseshoe theory is a real thing. Pillar 9, supporting climate justice around the world. I think this is the needs to have a global perspective on it. If your overarching climate policy is just about local things, you'll then, as we'll get on to, get into problems of you might fix things in your country, but overall make climate change worse. So you need to think about actual climate change on a global scale, and then combating environmental destruction and supply chains that power Europe. Because, you know, Europe imports a lot of things. So think about it from a European perspective. You need to think about that.
We'll name names later.
Indeed. Pillar 10. Coming into action today. This is kind of the main thing, which I will hark on about a lot, is that it's not a framework or treaty or agreement. It's a set of concrete actions that have to, like, happen now. And you have to start doing them now. Because it's great if you have a climate plan for 2050, which is what most countries are doing. They're saying, oh, we're going to have, like, net zero carbon emissions. We're going to reduce them by this percentage by, say, 2050 or 2030. Like, that's great, but that's quite a long away. And if you're saying, oh, in 11 years, this will happen. It's like, well, you're not going to be in government in 11 years. So if you say that now and you don't do any change this year, but you say, oh, we'll get to it next year, you're already behind. And whoever replaces you is going to set a new goal that they think they can achieve.
It's also worth pointing out that, like, a good example of this might require some, like, diving into archives of newspapers and stuff, but a lot of these agreements tend to have fixations on, like, nice round numbers.
Yes.
The big one nowadays is 2050. But once upon a time, 2020 was a big one.
Yes, oh, indeed, yeah.
You may have noticed that's next year. You'd have to go back into the list of things that, like, said they were going to do the X by 2020, because I have a sneaking suspicion a lot of them didn't make that goal. And it's due to the exact same thing you're talking about here, of, like, lofty goals that could always just be kicked down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And then not only are these things so far away, but they're also really close. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, we're here and none of this stuff happened.
Yeah, indeed. I think there's, like, if you look at previous attempts at doing this kind of stuff, and so, for instance, like, the Kyoto Protocol, which the commitment period was, like, so that was in the 90s, I think?
Yes,
yeah, so it's a treaty from 1992. And the goal was to, you know, decrease greenhouse gas emissions by 2012, whereas, you know, now it's 2019 and we're saying everyone needs to, like, really get serious about this.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you know, people didn't, you know, that didn't really fix everything. A lot of people that ended up, like, not ratifying it and whatnot. Canada withdrew. There was a whole thing of, that's great if you, like, put together a framework, but you actually have to locally be pushing this issue and getting individual or overarching, like, pieces of policy enacted. And actually on the road now, because I think especially any, like, red-green alliance or red-red alliance with like a green focus government needs to look at it from the perspective, or even at the EU level, with the, you know, red, blue, what color are our fucking Renew Europe is
yellow,
blue, is it yellow or is it
it's yellow,
sure, it's yeah, okay,
yeah, yeah. That's the color that was available, that's the color they're getting.
I'm sure they might pick blue. Anyway, yep. The yeah, so like the kind of center-right, center-left, liberal alliance, where all those parties say they want to do big climate goal things. If they're not doing stuff now, the future government, the future institution is not going to suddenly like catch up. They need to get ahead of the game now for the contingency of some future government might care about this less. Or some world event might happen and we'll care about this less. So if we don't get ahead of ourselves now, it's not going to happen.
Anyway. Yeah, especially if you're a big believer in like the idea of like pendulum swing politics, where like if something good happens, there's going to be a reaction.
Indeed.
So I think the strategy behind the Green New Deal is largely that which has been proven with something like the NHS, which is if you do something radical right away, maybe it doesn't take... Maybe to complete its goals won't happen in the period in which you're like, won't happen before your government gets kicked out for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But it will be such a sweeping material change for the majority of people that even though there are ideological opponents to it, and they even take over government, it just becomes incredibly difficult and just finicky to actually remove it.
Yep.
Even though Obamacare in the United States, the Affordable Health Care Act, was like not a very well put together policy and was kind of like a compromise on a compromise on a compromise.
Yes, on a plan from the 90s.
Yeah. It still actually rallied a large part of the like Republican base after they got like after they saw the benefits of it.
Yes.
I think it feels like a very long time ago, but I think people can turn their mind back to that like period immediately after Trump got elected, or like took the presidency, of like all those Republican town halls that were just complete like disasters for each Republican local politician or representative that called them.
So I think that getting around to what the specific recommendation that the people associated with the Green New Deal for Europe.com organization are putting forward, and what's his name, the guy, the DiEM25 policy guy,
David Adler.
So David Adler's like general plan, and this is, you know, similar to a lot of the stuff DiEM25 put out in general because of being associated with Yaros Varoufakis and other economists. Their plan effectively is you could for the next European Commission cycle replace what was the European Fund for Strategic Investments, which was colloquially referred to as the Juncker Plan, which was a like pushing via public-private partnerships infrastructure projects in Europe.
Yeah,
you could change that, like replace it with, but it's also kind of a renewal of, and you could continue a lot of the investments that were put forward. Like you put more money into some of the investments associated with that because some of them are green infrastructure projects. Change it to basically make it via the European Central Bank could issue green bonds, or the European Investment Bank could issue green bonds, and that would be backed by both the ECB and the like third party bond market. That therefore you're loaning money out for that is backed by the ECB for specifically for green infrastructure and schemes. And that way, you fulfill a lot of the promises of the Green New Deal. And once you start doing this, it would be very hard to roll back because you've already loaned out the money for a lot of big infrastructure projects that are specifically targeted at renewable energy, like infrastructure building transport links that are efficient trains and other things that are good for the environment and reduce the need for fossil fuel burning transportation. If you did that on a Europe-wide scale, like the estimates they're throwing out is there would be a 750,000 jobs created by something that's of a similar scale to what the Juncker plan was. So it wouldn't actually cost any more money. But if you pledge to redirect all of the money to and loans to green projects only, you would actually fulfill a lot of the requirements of their 10 pillars in such a plan, because it would all be that you would create a shitload of jobs. A lot of them would be high skill engineering jobs and long term like operating jobs for green like power generation, and it would also, you know, be really, really good for the environment in general. And it'd be very hard to get rid of, because once you've agreed to start funding like a big infrastructure project in a country, it'd be very hard for like a new European Commission to come in 5 years from now and say, oh yeah, we're gonna cut all the money from those like half built train networks.
I mean, it could happen, but I feel like it would be more at the national level. Like, I think there is the occasional horror story from across the world of a government just like cancelling like a half-built project.
But again,
I feel like you're right. It wouldn't happen at an EU level, because that would probably be viewed as an overreach.
Yes.
That's like one side of it, as like an overreach of their power. You gave us the money to do what we will with it. Don't tell us not to do what we will with it.
It would also be like fucking over specific places that were like, you know, as everything with the EU, some countries are going to be disproportionately benefiting more depending on what like projects got the funding. So part of it as well is they want to put together like a new piece of European bureaucracy that would decide what project gets through, as opposed to going through what existing channels there are to make sure it adheres to green only policies, which I think is smart. But this basically the main point of this is this would avoid any additional like tax raising to do. You know, similar to like Macron's approach of raising fuel tariffs and whatnot. It would be creating structural change that would make that not a problem, because people wouldn't be buying as much fuel if you give them a lot of green infrastructure and funding for green green transport schemes in countries.
That's probably like one of the biggest ones, and that's like the official Green New Deal for Europe campaign kind of thing, which is definitely interesting, especially like the aspect that I probably didn't know about it was the what we basically described as the hijacking of the Juncker plan. This is something we talked about off mic, about like the confused similes when it comes to the Green New Deal, especially when it was brought like internationally, because you know it was described to invoke the New Deal, which happened under the FDR government in the United States before World War II. And the thing is, though, that there's arguments that, you know, that's not actually within the collective public memory of a lot of countries.
They don't care.
So a good example of this is that the UK's Labour, their policy guy, John McDonnell, he advocates for... He has basically the exact same strategy for the UK, but it's called the Green Industrial Revolution, because for anyone who doesn't know, the Industrial Revolution is one of those like shining jewels of British history that is constantly brought up in like history classes. It's like one of the big things they did.
And similar to the New Deal, that has a lot of like, you know, inequality problems.
It's interesting because like the very funny tact of like, we're going to call it the Green Industrial Revolution. What are we doing? We're basically counteracting the effects of the Industrial Revolution. there's an interesting argument there to be made about like, should the Green New Deal branding be carried worldwide when it wasn't really a worldwide thing that's referencing? Are we just accepting American hegemony? Yada, yada, yada. Do we think that will work? Is this like being introduced to the public in different ways and different languages that we're not privy to, blah blah blah. But the thing I find really funny is that you could call it the Green Juncker plan and it would still have the same problem of like, that's not really in our public memory, the collective public memory, because
a lot of people responded, the Green who?
About five people knew what the Juncker plan was.
I am one of them.
And two of them are on this podcast.
I think there's the going back to the confused similes. There was like the other comparisons we've made to, oh, this is like the Green Marshall Plan. It's like, wait, you mean when America gave that's not what's happening here. America's not giving us any money.
That'd be cool if they were, though. That'd be great.
Yeah, that would be great. But that's not what's happening. And then
I think we'd have to get really into communism again to like do that.
Yeah, Jeremy Corbyn had a quote saying, "Just as the U.S. GI Bill gave education, housing, and income," and I was like, "Wait a minute, U.S. GI Bill. There's definitely things that have happened in the UK that are good. Like you could say just like the formation of the NHS or something. Like gave a big push."
I think the GI Bill was very specific, but because he was talking about the fact that like. We shouldn't be leaving existing energy workers behind.
Yes.
And we make sure that they're like sought to. But it is, you're right, there is like this weird mixed metaphor or mixed simile, as you called it, problem with like the internationality of the Green New Deal.
Indeed.
Yeah. But moving on to some of the other things you read.
Oh, some of the things I read. Going on more of a. We'll get into individual countries in a bit. Okay. I think individual national countries, because like I have one and then you have a few.
Yes.
But there was like a pretty good article that a friend of the podcast, Ed Miliband, wrote for Prospect Magazine, which I think is the shadiest name for a magazine I've ever heard. Mm. But it's good from the perspective of because he was environment, like, or the energy and climate change secretary, which was like a new position they created in Gordon Brown's government for him. A lot of the article is about things like from the perspective of having previously been in the role that would be in charge of coming up with and or implementing a lot of what this stuff would be, how that hasn't worked out in the past, and like looking back as to like both really obvious mistakes and then things that you know, have happened since that kind of give some context to previous efforts. So I think one of the main ones, which is part of, like, it's one of the pillars of the New Green Deal for Europe thing is there is community action today. And the way Ed Miliband put it was that, like, looking back, it's easy to regret that we weren't more imaginative about their plans. So, like, one of his examples is there was a car scrappage scheme where they were, like, subsidizing people scrapping their cars to encourage people to buy cars that were better emission standards, and that would in turn lower emissions. And there's like, but that was like a really good opportunity for them to have spent that money instead on infrastructure for electric powered vehicles. Like instead of the car scrapper scheme, you spent all the money on companies that were doing research into battery powered cars as like subsidies plus infrastructure for like powering like charging stations. You could spend all that money on that and that would have like tipped the scale towards like jumping over the current generation of cars, but they just like at the time it was very much about cool, so there's like the financial crash is happening, we need to like fix things for people short term, here's a way to like make sure the car industry doesn't collapse in the short term. But it's like that's probably not what the energy and climate change secretary should have been thinking about. They should have been cool, well, if our goal for, say, like at the time was probably 2020, if our goal for 2020 is this, what could we do now to get us ahead of the curve instead of what could we do now to just like barely keep on the curve or like go under it a little bit? I thought it was like interesting from the perspective of like that policy is a good example of like that is a good idea and was popular and did achieve what its point was, but. That shouldn't have been what its point was. They could have done something more ambitious with that wouldn't have necessarily cost more money or been any less popular, but it would have been long-term more beneficial. One of his other points was that, like, as I mentioned previously, the Green New Deal, as it was originally coined by New Economic Foundation, exactly, has been around for more than 10 years. And like he was aware of it as when he was climate change secretary. It's just kind of like I knew about this and thought it was a great idea, but like the cogs weren't moving because partially because of the people involved. But maybe the time has come for it now, and we should really all get on, we should now get on board, because we're all aware of what happens when you don't get on board with something like this, is that stuff kind of ticks along the way it's going, and you get some good policies and then some bad policies, and some things that don't quite work out. So, like, now is the time to be ambitious, and we tried not being ambitious, it didn't work.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's like the good shorthand approach. The other thing, which is a UK-centric example, is that, like, so he compares it to education, is that, like, no party goes out saying that they shouldn't, like, in the UK anyway, that they shouldn't spend more money on education. But everyone actually disagrees on how that should be done, and people do argue about that, because they all have very clear different arguments and different things they want. So, like, in a previous recent election, there was, like, a should money be spent on grammar schools thing in the UK, which is kind of, like, a weird selective higher education, or, like, secondary education thing. But people weren't doing that with climate change, because the Paris Agreement effectively happened, and all the parties got together and were like, yeah, we all endorse this. This is a great, great goal. But they didn't actually get into the brass tacks of how they were going to do it. And they should be arguing about it. So it was kind of like a, what you need to do is pick a really clear policy position, a set of policies you want done. And anyone who disagrees with you, argue with them. Even if their goal is the same, they probably want something different. And they want to do it in a different way, which might be bad. And the other one was that the whole framing of net zero, this is like on a similar vein, the whole idea of like net zero carbon, and everyone agrees like, okay, we're all going to aim for net zero carbon by 2050. I was like, but some people mean net zero carbon as it's calculated currently, and some people mean net zero consumption, which is different, because so net zero carbon, like the example used in that article was that if steel is made in the UK, which is like a declining industry, that doesn't count towards emissions, but steel made in China or elsewhere in Europe even doesn't count towards the UK's emissions if it's shipped to the UK and used for something. They only calculate the emissions of whatever the manufacturer using the steel did. So actually the UK's emissions might by themselves go down year on year, but that's because of continued decline in heavy industry and not actually consumption changes. He quoted Dieter Helm, who's an energy policy professor at Oxford, who just says, if you really want to reduce global warming, it doesn't matter where the emissions take place, and therefore the only way to judge it is with carbon consumption. So I guess there's the, while advocating a particular set of policies, we also need to be really conscious of how the argument is being framed, because it might be bad.
I think the other side of this as well, and something that we kind of encountered through like trying to find if there was ever like a carbon consumption index anywhere, which I don't think there is. We haven't been able to find one, because it's probably a very hard thing to calculate.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, but the other side of it,
I think people probably would be conscious of actually calculating it, because they'd be like, well, we don't want to double count stuff. And it's like, but I think that's fine. I think you should double count things. So like the steel example, that steel should just be counted twice, because you also shipped it somewhere.
Yeah, that's another good argument. But the like the other side of this is like there's a fixation on carbon as well, when other like when greenhouse gases is also like a broader category.
Yeah.
We encountered this, and this might lead into like our discussion of individual countries, but we encountered this while looking at Ireland's greenhouse emissions. Per capita, Ireland has the highest greenhouse emissions but the second highest carbon emissions. Poland beats us in carbon, but Poland is like a massive coal producing country, whereas I believe Ireland's greenhouse, like why we edge out, is because of our beef industry, which is huge, and it's also huge because we export it. Irish beef is very popular here in Germany. It's also very popular in China. So there is this kind of section of like, in particular with China, because China is like the biggest greenhouse producer in the world. But like most things in China, and this isn't like really up for debate, most things in China are produced for an external market. Like there is just like whole sections of the warehouse in a Chinese factory where like, and that's the stuff going to Australia, or that's the stuff going to the US. There was no like debate about whether, oh, are we going to use this internally in China? No, probably not.
I think, once you look at like even emissions, once you start looking at per capita, then the orders start changing very quickly. Like the US and stuff are still quite high up, but like China ends up way down those lists comparatively. Yes. Ireland still ranked quite highly and in some indexes above China, but neither here nor there. I think Ireland is a good example of how to do this with how you could have a overall green policy plan that does not adhere to a lot of the problems and pitfalls that we've identified so far. So like part of Ireland's overall plan put forward by the centre-right ruling Fine Gael party is part of it involves buying carbon credits from other countries. And that's very clearly getting into the pitfall of, cool, so you're viewing this as like an accounting thing that you as a country need to look good, but you actually are falling into the pitfall of, well, you actually might overall not improve climate change because you're buying into this system that is not designed to do that properly. Yeah. And has a lot of problems. And also then a lot of the left-wing parties, and in the article I'm reading, it says including Sinn Féin, which again, I think problems with, oppose some of the measures because, like a lot of centre-right parties, they're still bringing in, like, carbon taxes that affect individuals and small businesses, like, more than...
They're a regressive taxation, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And then also basically just doing a version of what their original, like, proposal was. That's slightly worse for some reason. So, like, a lot of their policies are kind of things that other parties have put forward and were laughed down, and then they're saying, and now this is our new policy, and you're like, that's very similar to the other one, but you've just made it a bit worse,
you've made it evil.
So like, it's again, they should be talking about it, they should have a policy for it, and this is I think really important why all the opposition parties should have their own version of this plan with specific things they would do differently. Yeah. And explaining why that would be better for overall consumption and not emissions calculations.
Yeah. Going into more like individual nations' plans, this is kind of where I like deep dived into, and I found some like interesting things that I think would be great to like talk about maybe, or bring to like more European level, because the other side of a European Green New Deal is, or Green New Deal for Europe, to get the branding correct, is that it doesn't necessarily have to happen at a European level. It could be like coordinated, like 28 individual Green New Deals.
Yeah,
kind of. Although it's really hard to, as we saw with the carbon consumption discussion, it's very hard for this not to be like an internationalist discussion.
Yes.
Because this is one of the things that, like I said, I would name names earlier. This is one of the things Sweden does, where Sweden has like a pretty good, like, based on the existing metrics that are quite popular, very good environmentally, Sweden. Mm-hmm. But they have a tendency to just export all their waste to other countries. I think there was a case recently where I believe it was either Malaysia or Indonesia just sent some of it back, being like, fuck off, basically. So getting into more specific stuff, is there was actually a good deal written about like Spain's kind of concept of a Green New Deal, or Podemos's idea of a Green New Deal, which I find very interesting. It's worth pointing out that the Green New Deal, or like environmentalist side of Podemos, is actually relatively recent. But it was something that's been incorporated now and wholesale part of the party, because I think we discussed this in like EU election stuff, but Spain doesn't really have a Green Party. Podemos has adequately filled that space, but Podemos started as specifically an anti-austerity party. They were directly came from these anti-austerity protests. Those were big ones after like 2008 that involved like 8 million people at last estimate, which is 20% of the population of Spain.
Jesus, right, okay, yeah.
They were called the, like, there's a really cool Spanish word that I've forgotten at the moment, but for what they were called, but yeah, it's not important. So the two positions that they kind of had in like most recent elections were the Green New Deal plus like a reproductive rights package that they basically they had a lot of like town hall meetings with like feminist movements in Spain and incorporated their policies of things like, you know, free childcare and stuff like that. But the Green New Deal stuff, because what we're talking about this episode, their plans are to establish a number of strategic public companies, one including a state investment bank to secure Spain's energy transition to 100% renewables over the next 20 years. That's their plan. They plan to keep this all very municipal, like
on a municipal level.
Basically, they want to create a public energy company, but one that is run at like a municipal level. The challenges they're seeing to that, though, is that like there is this kind of like oligopoly of like energy companies in Spain. Reading into it is very reminiscent of like internet service providers in the United States. So that's like a bit of a problem, even though like Spain as a country has the potential for everyone to be like every household to be somewhat energy independent, because you can just throw solar panels onto the roof.
It's hot and sunny.
It is hot and sunny in Spain. But like obviously that won't cover you 100% of the time, so the rest has to be like controlled at a local level. They also really focus on the idea of a program of mass public employment, which is, you know, the Green New Deal kind of stuff. Creation of hundreds of thousands of jobs. They kind of talked about the fact that, like, it's becoming more of a talking point in Spain and kind of a rallying call, which I find really interesting, because this is a very... A lot of this stuff to be bottom... Like, the reason why you want this stuff to be bottom up is because you can get into very specific talking points that will resonate with people. But one of the slogans, or one of the things that's constantly getting brought up nowadays, is that the Sahara now technically starts in Spain.
of course it does.
Because the huge concern with climate change in Spain is desertification. Which is why like tree planting is also like a really big part of like environmentalism in Spain. Yeah, and there's also this great quote that I found from, I'm assuming this is probably a Spanish name, so forgive me, but it's Jarna Assens, or probably Jarna Assens. But the quote she has is, if the planet was a bank, it would have been bailed out by now.
Right. I think that's like that, like that comes on to the same theme of the Green New Deal for Europe stuff, which is you could funnel this via like a set of like an investment bank and bonds, and you can make in order to keep a lot of people happy, and this is great pushing from the left for this, but in order to get everyone on board really quickly, what you could do is do this via a state investment bank or Europe-wide investment bank that loans out money to private companies to do this. So basically, like, if your problem is that there's an oligopoly of energy companies in Spain, if say money from the investment bank is only available for renewables projects, those companies will start switching to a lot of renewable stuff, because that's where all the free loans and money is.
Yes, good money. So here's the to kind of keep talking about Spain just for a little bit more, is that, again, going back to the municipalism kind of aspect, is we have Ada Colau in Barcelona, who has accomplished a lot of like greening of Barcelona's economy on a very local level. This works for Spain because, again, Spain has a lot of municipalist control. So this is, again, this is why it has to be bottom up, because strategies in different countries are going to look different in different places. We also have Mas Madrid, which is this new kind of splinter party that only exists in Madrid. They offer as one of their green policies the object libraries as like an effort of reducing consumption in a way where people still have access to things they need, which is pretty cool. I like that. Moving on to some UK proposals. This is largely coming from Labour Party's John McDonnell. A lot of the same stuff again, where, you know, we really need to raise up the working class, make sure that they aren't like affected too harshly by an economic transition, which he kind of invokes Thatcher's deindustrialization of the UK as like an example of where the working class was very much damaged by an economic transition in the UK. But here's one of the policies that I found off of theirs, which I found very interesting, which is removing British companies from the London Stock Exchange if they don't meet certain green criteria.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good just acknowledging like capitalist institution from someone who would, like, I'm sure if you asked him, he would be like, oh, I'd really rather transition to a system where there was no London Stock Exchange. And he's like, but if for a moment we could focus on green issues, then he'd be like, oh yeah, well, we could just do that and use this stock exchange for our advantage. That's a good idea. That's interesting. Yeah, that's you can do a lot of things that are like that doesn't really fit the doesn't fit the don't focus too heavily on top downs criteria. But I think there are a lot of like stuff like that do make it. Well, just make either the punishment for not changing really bad, then people will probably just change themselves. They're unlikely to just leave if they're a British company because it costs them a lot of money. Traded. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I also found that there was a Labour Party conference recently that had a pamphlet called Green Transformation. Mm. And one of the few things that I'm seeing so far that focused on biodiversity. Mm. Which is something that I feel like, so here's Ciarán's kind of like conspiracy corner, but so the big environmental movement at the moment is Extinction Rebellion, or they're like one of them anyway. There's also Fridays for Future, but Extinction Rebellion pretty much gets their name from the concept that we are going through an extinction event at the moment.
Yes.
And this is indicated by the fact that like a lot of species are dying. There's even a death of like insect species, which is usually very, very rare for extinction events. Mm-hmm. So like that's all very concerning, but I also feel like that message of theirs has been like distracted away from, and they're now just kind of focusing on more like climate change stuff.
Yeah,
and this like relates into biodiversity because the biggest threat to biodiversity is agriculture, and I feel like the agricultural lobby is very strong.
yeah, that's true. And there is the problem with like a lot of agriculture is very bad for localized climate change effects happening more quickly. So for instance, like there's a lot of like water and soil nutrients being taken away from like heavy agriculture places. So like a good example of this is in the US, there's a lot of fruit and vegetables get shipped from California to elsewhere. You end up with desertification problems in California because a lot of soil nutrients and water are being like shipped elsewhere in the country arbitrarily. Mm-hmm. And part of it's because of people not eating locally and whatnot, but like there's a lot of money to be made in doing that. So I guess that is like this point you should probably focus on more.
Yeah, and before I go into like more pie in the sky stuff, I just wanted to bring up the situation in France, which I think requires a bit of a kind of re-emphasis. This happened a while ago, but basically Emmanuel Macron kind of campaigned on like environmentalist positions and posture. But that's, I think this is well known within France, but this mightn't be reaching the rest of the continent, which is he basically has just dropped all of that. He hired as like, he appointed as his green minister a well-known activist, environmental activist by the name of Nicolas Hulot, or Nicolas Hulot. It's a French name. But Nicolas Hulot very publicly resigned, noting the president's indifference towards climate questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was also like huge outcry with a huge petition signed by 2 million people, most of whom were like Liberal Republican March voters who were like, you need to focus more on environment.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also worth pointing out that the Green Party in France is not sufficiently radical enough, I would say, to actually affect change on a climate policy level. But pie in the sky stuff, interesting things to think about. A lot of this I got from like the idea of from Jackman article called The Green New Deal's Five Freedoms, which you know, there'll be a link in the description. And so there's three things that I found very interesting out of that article, which is one, guaranteeing rights to food, water, and a stormproof shelter. Because one of the things I feel like the Green New Deal is kind of ignoring sometimes is, mainly because it's a bit of a downer, but is the apocalyptic nature of all of this.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And they would point, like, their kind of pointing out that a lot of like inevitable conflict that would arise from like rapid changes in the climate could be avoided if we did public works projects or like government schemes that guaranteed people food, water, and stormproof shelter.
Mm-hmm.
Stormproofing shelter is not terribly costly. It can be incorporated from like the get-go with construction of houses and stuff. It often is in a lot of regions in the world. A good example would be that like almost everything in California has to be earthquake proof. So you know that is doable. And I've heard people suggesting the idea that we do what Cuba does with food, which is basically everyone gets sent a box of some essential foodstuffs. Which I kind of like the idea of. It's basically naturalizing what's that company called? Eat Fresh or something?
Yeah, the one that ships you the food and the...
Yeah, I think the Cuba box scheme is more you get like oil and flour. And salt and these like things that if you were really struggling, you could make like a flatbread with.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, yeah. So yeah. It's kind of the allowing everyone to be what are the people who are preppers? Everyone gets their free prepper stuff.
Yeah, everyone gets like plated. That was it. That's the American one. That's probably a bit extravagant, but and also this would be something I think you could adjust for very municipal, local, or national levels, where one, the things you're giving out to people actually reflect the eating habits of the population, because there are things that are more important to certain groups than others, like other nationalities, and also you could probably do a scheme where things are kept local.
That's an interesting idea. I think it's interesting from the perspective of like the whole limit warming to 1.5 degrees thing is at 1.5 degrees, like again going back to the apocalyptic nature of this whole thing, there will be a continuation of the heavy increase in very, very bad storms and flooding and forest fires. They won't stop.
Yeah.
So you need to kind of plan for them. I think stormproof shelter is kind of I think you could extend that to, you know, flood prevention and
So what I mean
wildfire
by
prevention. Yeah, right. Yeah.
This is the way I summarized it, but basically, yeah, a climate apocalypse proof shelter.
Yeah, climate apocalypse acknowledgement shelter.
Acknowledgement shelter. Yeah, yeah. We can only do so much. And going into the water one, which is something that I'm starting to see more cities do, but I think needs to become the norm everywhere.
Yeah.
And that is public drinking fountains.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, yeah.
They're the norm in a lot of places in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
More accurately, historically, have been the norm. I feel like they're kind of like rolling that shit back nowadays. They're reintroducing it in Germany or in Berlin, anyway.
Yeah.
But I think it's something like, oh, people complain, it's like, oh, they'd get dirty. It was like, well, if you want to create jobs, how about people who fucking go around and clean the things on a regular basis?
Wouldn't need a lot of people to do that, actually. It'd be fine.
Yeah. And there's also like a whole like, maybe we should sympathize with homeless people, because access to water for someone sleeping rough is probably fairly important, especially in countries that might be getting hotter soon.
Yes.
Another one is that I took from this article is like two kind of mobility things.
Mm-hmm.
First is free public transport. Free public transport schemes that, like, I think we talked about in this podcast when Luxembourg introduced their free public transport nationwide.
Yeah.
That shit needs to happen, because it disincentivizes people from using personal transport, which is damaging to the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think also makes things nicer in general.
I agree.
Yeah. And then another one, which is probably fairly radical, but also quite important, which is borderless societies. Because a problem with borders, especially when countries' climates start to radically change, is that you might end up trapped in a hellscape. There's really good work by this one Indian anthropologist that I'm struggling to think of the name of, but he kind of has a very good argument that basically famines didn't exist before the nation state. There were periods of hunger, but the thing that happened when there was like, you know, pestilence or like a crop failed is you moved. There's been no such thing, or at least within humans' existence, there's been no such thing as a global famine. There was always food somewhere. So, yeah, I think that that kind of just, when I saw that in the article, I was reminded of that, like, finding, which is, yeah, if you trap people within borders, there's nothing to say that, like, climate change is not going to affect each country equally, is a good way of putting it. People have kind of made arguments of the strategic value that maybe Russia would gain from climate change, where Russia gets warmer and they also have access to the Arctic Ocean.
Yeah,
things like that. But allowing people to move, I can't imagine a lot of countries in North Africa are going to fare well.
No, but you know what, Kieran, I live in Brexit land, and we're just going to make more borders, and it, and we're going to do some clever accounting, and the UK is going to be carbon neutral.
Very nice. And this is, here's my last pie in the sky thing, and I want to get your take on this, because this is something that's actually already exists in Germany, but it hasn't really had to be enforced because it was never really a problem before. But workplace temperature regulation.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so Germany has things in place that if a if the workplace temperature exceeds a certain amount, and they can't they can't make it lower via some mechanism, you all get to go home. Or basically some sort of compensation for the fact that, like, parts of our country or parts of our day-to-day lives might change. And I don't think this is actually a thing in every country. I know there are situations like it's considered workplace abuse if things are too cold, and you haven't been provided with, you know, like thermal gear or something like that.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty common, but, like, we might need to start looking at the other direction.
Yeah, what if it's too hot? And right. Yeah, that's interesting. I think that, again, that's like a very easy policy to just tack on to
any
existing plan, and then you've just ticked another, like, another box that was easy and would be universally quite popular, other than with someone who runs some sort of, I don't know, heat place.
Exceptions for saunas.
Yeah.
Sauna workers.
This is how warm it is. I'm just like, I can't think of a job that where it would be warm. all jobs seem like they're hot to me now.
Yeah, right.
If you're a computer programmer at a furnace factory, I don't know.
I program smart furnaces. It's an interesting one because, again, I think it would be quite popular, but also I think it's something that needs to be handled at, like, maybe state or national level, because I was thinking suspicion what a Swedish person considers too hot to work at is probably quite different from what a Spanish person considers too hot to work at. But all those countries are going to get warmer, so
it would not be unreasonable for someone, for instance, the Green New Deal for Europe people, to have, alongside their 10 pillars, a list of, like, policies that, if your country doesn't already do this, just do this. Suggested policies that will all be very easy to just come up with a version that, like, is more applicable to your place, or, like, a slight tweak on it. That, and complicated bond market European Investment Bank stuff are the two things I'm endorsing in this podcast.
And I'm endorsing nationalizing food preparers.
I mean, sure. That's my one problem. So this is my one problem with that, is that that has an inefficiency of some people just don't, like, cook well, and, like, wouldn't use some of the stuff that, like, there'd be some stuff that could be in that where people are just like, I don't want this, because, like, so say you had flour, which I think the vast majority of people use in most European countries. You have a lot of people who would be like, well, I have celiac disease. Why am I getting shipped flour?
Yeah. So there is, going back to, like, the only place that does this, which is Cuba.
Yeah.
The studies on that have shown there's, like, a handful of solutions to this, which is people trade amongst themselves.
Right.
Everyone gets the box, but then they're like, I want more eggs and you want more flour.
Seeing as it's 2019, I have a different solution.
I
propose an app which is just a tick box form, but it'll cost tens of thousands of euros to produce, and I'd happily produce it.
That's the other solution, where, you know, food requirements are brought into it.
Fill out a form, that'd be easy.
Yeah. But there's also things like in Cuba, people would just pile their boxes together and they would just do big communal cooking things. Which I think if this box exists for emergency situations would be probably more commonplace than it is now.
Yeah. Anyway, that'd be nice.
That would be nice. And that was another episode of Previously in Europe. Previously in Europe is produced and created by Hugh O'Brien and Kieran Dold. If you like the podcast, tell your friends about it. That kind of stuff really helps. And, you know, we notice when you do that, there's little spikes in the numbers. Tell your friends. It's really cool. Also, you can support us on Patreon. Patreon is a fab little website, if you don't know, that allows you to support creators that you think are worthy of supporting. We have a handful of tiers that will get you different benefits. Such benefits include access to a bonus monthly episode and the ability to like make suggestions to the podcast that we technically have to abide by. We have done that so far for anyone who questions us. And also, similarly, if you donate up $5 or more, you do get your name said on the podcast, like these cool cats: Dermot Burke, Dreers Arian, Justin Paul Sammons, Lisa Shalagina, Michael Hall, and Niall McLaughlin. So if you want to be read out like those cool cats, you know what you have to do. patreon.com/previouslyinEurope. Similarly, you can leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you leave podcast reviews. I think iTunes is called Apple Podcasts, and I think also Spotify has a review function now. So if you leave a review there, more people hear about us. That's great. We're on all the social medias. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. And we have an email, previouslyineurope@gmail.com. You can get all of this information if you go to previouslyineurope.eu. Thanks for listening.